I'm Bill Radke. This is KUOW's The Record. Let's talk more about Seattle's move against gay conversion therapy. As you just heard, Seattle became America's third city to outlaw the practice. And reporter Sydney Brownstone with The Stranger broke down in tears as she watched the city council unanimously pass that resolution. She told me why the vote affected her so deeply.
I've never expected myself to cry during a city council meeting because sometimes they can be pretty boring. But I started tearing up when Lorena Gonzalez said that being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender is not an illness, nor does it need a cure. For some reason, that just kind of started the waterworks.
Why was that so emotional for you?
I think anyone who is gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender or gender nonconforming or asexual has interactions with people who are supposed to love and support them that are not necessarily loving and supporting. When I came out to a very close family member of mine, someone who loves me dearly, would do anything in the world for me, I told that person that I wasn't straight. They just looked at me and they said, "Yes, you are. You're not gay." And it was really kind of crushing. And that's not the worst thing you can go through by any measure of the imagination. Conversion therapy is especially relevant for people who grow up in deeply religious households whose parents are not only in denial that their children are gay or transgender or bisexual, but want to cure them, want to fix them, see something as deeply wrong with them. And I think that just in the culture, you know, we're sent that message almost every day. There's something wrong with you.
Let's bring all of our listeners with us who don't know what conversion therapy is.
Mm-hmm. So conversion therapy is this debunked, bogus, pseudoscientific practice in which therapists or religious leaders will try to take children often and cure them of being gay. Cure them of being transgender. So they go through these ridiculous regimens where they're taught to, you know, reckon with their sexual urges, and then it doesn't cure you, obviously. It just creates lasting damage.
One of the council members, Deborah Juarez, compared conversion therapy to this country's treatment of Native Americans.
Yeah, I thought that was so important. You know, I think that we grow up thinking that everyone in the United States is born free. No matter who you are, no matter where you come from, you can accomplish whatever you want, just whatever your dreams aspire to be. And what she was saying is that that's actually not quite true. There's actually a very long history of forced assimilation in the United States, and conversion therapy for gay people is not the only example. For hundreds of years, and up until the 1970s, so very recently, Native American children were taken from their families and forced into boarding schools. And the motto of those boarding schools was, "Kill the Indian, save the man." So it was a type of, Canada has recognized this type of treatment as cultural genocide. It was literally trying to erase a cultural identity. And it's the same MO in conversion therapy. You know, you have these people trying to erase who you are, and it's so dehumanizing and so traumatic.
So let's talk about what this law, this new Seattle City law, actually does. Therapists who are found practicing conversion therapy get a $500 fine for the first time, a $1,000 fine after that. The city doesn't have the power to take a therapist's license away. So, Sydney Brownstone, you know city council pretty well because of your job. When you put on your reporter hat here, do you think the possibility of getting fined will actually prevent therapists from doing conversion therapy?
Here's how I see the significance of this measure, because I hear in that question, like, the Seattle City Council often passes meaningless resolutions that are really annoying and have no impact, and I completely agree with that. In this case, I think it will have a real financial impact. Like, it's a clear financial disincentive to practice conversion therapy. Do we know how many people are actually practicing conversion therapy in Seattle? No. But I think we need to recognize when Seattle as a city has national significance. You know, we are not just playing in our own pond here. If Seattle can show that you can create create financial disincentives for conversion therapy on a city level, I can see easily how other cities, maybe in Republican-dominated state legislatures, would want to replicate this. I mean, this year, the Republican National Committee came out with the most homophobic platform in history. The Republican Party has pushed farther to the right than it maybe ever has. And it's getting increasingly difficult to get any kind of progressive policies passed at the state level. So this is a moment to realize that Seattle can be a model in the same way that a $15 minimum wage was.
As you know, there are people who don't like the city's move, people who say that restricting what a therapist can say in their work is not only something a government shouldn't do, but they can't, that it's an assault on that therapist's free speech. What do you make of that?
This isn't like a therapist going on their own personal Facebook page and going, I think gay people need to be cured. That's one thing. This is a therapist taking someone's money, taking someone's trust, and then harming them. So, you know, I don't think the issue is free speech necessarily. I think it's consumer protection. And in New Jersey, that's the lawsuit that we saw. These therapists, these conversion therapy organizations, got sued for violating consumer protection laws. At the end of the day, they're peddling false science. They're peddling false treatment. To me, if we didn't have this financial disincentive, they would be legally liable for the type of harm that they're perpetuating anyway.
Sydney, we've talked about the effect that the city of Seattle's move could have on other governments, the effect it could have on therapists who may or may not be practicing this in the city. What effect do you think the city's law has on people, especially young people?
I think it gets young people engaged with the political process. It's rare to have a story kind of blow up on your newsfeed. And, you know, when I was watching the city council meeting, I wrote maybe like a 4-paragraph blog post about it. This was not something that I put a ton of time and effort into, but people all across the country that I knew started sharing it and started cheering it and saying, hey, yeah, the Seattle City Council did something really, really right. I think during this national election, a lot of young people are feeling apathy. They feel like they're stuck between two subpar choices, and it's hard for people to get engaged on a local level. But this is a reminder that local is where the change often happens. And we're actually, today is the last day you can vote in the August primary. So if you have your ballots, please put them in a ballot box or mail them in. The turnout thus far is really depressingly low, but this is what happens when you elect progressive candidates. This is what happens. They pass progressive policies and you can see change. You can see people become encouraged and politically active in your own neighborhood.
Sydney Brownstone is a reporter for The Stranger. We were talking there about the city's move against gay conversion therapy. At the end, though, you also heard her mention that it's voting day today. It's the August primary ballot day. You can send it in by the end of the day. You can drop it off at a ballot box. And as she said, not many of us have. Depressingly low, said Sydney Brownstone, and I have a number on that. The state secretary of state's office puts turnout so far at about 18%. And probably it'll hit 40% by the end of the day when all the ballots are in. Professor Todd Donovan teaches political science at Western Washington University. He says low turnout, that's not unusual. It's summertime. People are vacationing. Plus, primary races can be boring.
It's hard to get the average voter really excited about the stuff that's on the primary ballot unless we had, you know, an open Senate race with a really active campaign going on. You know, the average voter isn't really touched that much by these kind of primaries. As you know, you compare this to the presidential primary a couple months ago, which didn't even matter for one of the parties. But that's something that's in the news. It's Sanders and Trump and Clinton, and that got attention. We don't have that really going on right now for this primary in August.
Who cares? And what does it mean for democracy when there is such a low primary turnout?
There's sort of an irony here because as a state, we've really bent over backwards to try to increase turnout in our primaries. We vote by mail. We have this open top two thing where independents can vote. And at the end of the day, you know, we'll be lucky to get 40%. If that was November, I think that'd be something to be worried about. But in August, when we're really just winnowing the field to who will be on the ballot in November, I don't think it says anything bad about the state of democracy in Washington.
Well, the winnowing the field part, that's important too, right?
Yeah, it is. And again, you know, we've opened it up so everybody can participate in this, but how do you get the average voter to be excited about the races here that are competitive this year? And they're really kind of down ballot things. You know, the one thing that is maybe going to be mobilizing locally is the 7th district race, the congressional race filling Jim McDermott's seat. I mean, that one is actually, that's an example of something that is out there right now that maybe has national implications in terms of who represents Seattle. But unless we have something like that statewide, we're just not really going to see high levels of engagement with this primary.
Which means those few of us who have voted in the primary wasted our time?
No, I wouldn't say that. The main reason most people vote is a sense of civic duty. So, you know, that's an expressive sort of attachment to the system. So people do that, you know, they're wearing their I voted sticker. So I wouldn't say it's wasting time, but you know, you got to ask yourself how many people are going to be doing the research to find of X number of Democratic candidates, which one is the one that they want for lands commissioner or that they want for auditor, or of X number of Republican candidates. You know, the people who are engaged with that, that's the 40% we're seeing voting. And so they're not wasting their time. But, you know, the other thing, too, is that, you know, the low turnout today doesn't mean that we're going to have low turnout in November. November is a completely different thing. We're going to have a presidential race. We're going to have initiatives. And that's going to bring in all these voters who are kind of sitting on their hands today.
So then your message to someone who hasn't voted yet but could, with a little effort, you're saying what?
Take 5 minutes and do some research and you know, look at the candidates. There's some really crowded races there. And in a low turnout year, your vote's going to matter more than it normally would. So, you know, some things there's a chance, depending on how the cards fall, that we might end up with two candidates of the same party in some of these races going on in November. And if that's something people are concerned about, they should, you know, look at their ballot, look at the voter's pamphlet, and do something about it.
Todd Donovan, professor of political science at Western Washington University. He is also an elected Whatcom County Council member. So, if you do want to vote in the primary election and you haven't done it yet, you've got till 8 tonight, ballots postmarked by 8 o'clock, ballots dropped at one of those official ballot boxes, those will all be counted. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. You'll find our election coverage at KUOW.org. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. One of the beauties of a Seattle summer is blueberries. Blueberries with ice cream. Blueberries with whipped cream. Blueberries all alone. You can grow them around here. My family goes to the Mercer Slough U-Pick, but it's hard to grow organic blueberries in bulk in this region. Just too many bugs and disease on the west side. Now, that gets better east of the mountains, but then water becomes an issue. How can blueberries grow in a desert? KUOW's Anna King has a solution. She's near a town called Patterson in south central Washington looking at giant tents.
I've been seeing these from the road, but it's just a totally different experience to be under one. It looks like a wedding tent that's just gargantuan.
We're just in our own little world.
That's Rob Wolf. He manages everything on this piece of ground and the 1,000 workers under this tent. He's right. It feels like its own world. This tent we're under houses 154 acres of contiguous blueberries. That's a quarter square mile, or like 45 Costco warehouses stitched together. That's just one tent. Right here, he has several more. I'm on one of the many ranches Zirkel Fruit Company owns. The company has a patchwork of farms from the Canadian border to Oregon's southern flank. About 10 years ago, Zirkel Company was just experimenting with a bit of cloth for birds and cherries. Now these tents cover large swaths of that massive farming operation. Another farm manager, Harold Austin, says they're doing this because organic blueberries are very tender. but one of the top money-making crops in the nation.
What we're trying to do is take a crop that's typically grown in 50 to 80 inches of rain in western Washington, and we're trying to grow it in eastern Washington, where we receive less than 8 to 10 inches of rainfall annually.
This shade cloth helps farmers grow about 20 to 30% more marketable fruit, they say. It protects these drip irrigation pampered berries from the sun and wind, and the canopy keeps many of the birds out, but not all. This farm worker's full-time job is to walk 10 miles a day under here. He chases the birds that get in here with a long whittled poplar stick and a firecracker pistol. The farmers don't want the birds to get too comfortable and eat their fill. Some of the farm workers here say they prefer working under the canopies than under the direct sun. Picking crew boss Miguel Lugo says it does get humid and hot under the canopy, but...
Well, it gives you a little bit more protection from the sun. It's pretty much like a little shield.
This shade cloth is a hassle for farmers, though. It costs $15,000 to $20,000 an acre to put up. And sometimes, especially early on, farm manager Wolf says the canopies would fall down or rip apart.
And as soon as one wire breaks, it's like a domino effect. And yeah, that wasn't a great morning for me when I showed up and half of my field was laying over on its side.
Now they're better at building the fruit tents stronger for high winds. Just this farm site has a full-time crew of a dozen men that maintain these canopies. They're like skilled sailors, except for they use motorized lifts to reach the 18-foot-tall billows of scrim. They constantly repair holes and tears with plastic zip ties, like thread and needle both. Now I've climbed into the farm's private helicopter, and from the sky, it's hard to tell that these white blocks below us aren't buildings. Cloth suppliers are now bringing in the shade material from China and New Zealand, and they say they're selling more yarns than they ever have. Soon, we'll see more and more of the Northwest's fruit enclosed from view. I'm Anna King, outside of Patterson, Washington.
And on KUOW's The Record, we move from a summer delicacy to the summer games. In 1936, the University of Washington rowing team went to the Olympics in Nazi-occupied Berlin, and against all odds, they beat everyone, including the champion German team. That story became a best-selling book by Daniel James Brown called The Boys in the Boat. But within that underdog story is another story, the story of UW rowing team member Joe Rance. Rance's daughter, Judy Willman, thought that her father's difficult childhood and his eventual triumph at the 1936 Olympics made for its own amazing story, and she brought it to that author, Daniel James Brown, who agreed with her. KUOW's Marcy Silman asked Judy to describe her father's childhood in one word. Judy had to think about that for a second.
Discarded. His mother died when he was less than four, and his father just sort of lost it. Eventually, his father remarried, and I don't know what was going on with that dynamic, but it was like with his father, it was like he had no more will to do anything, and with the stepmother, she never did take to dad. He was a constant reminder of the first marriage. And so there were a number of times where he was banished or kicked out or, you know, sent somewhere else. But when he was 15, he came home from school one day and they had the car packed. The stepmother had basically said, I'm leaving and I'm taking the kids to my grandfather. And you can stay or come as you like, but Joe can't come. And so they left.
The story is amazing, as Dan Brown tells it in the book. And what's even more amazing, I think, is coming from the kind of background and being discarded the way your father was. It's amazing that he ended up at the University of Washington at all, much less on a champion rowing team, much less winning a gold medal. Are you surprised at all that he was able to accomplish all this?
I am at this point. I think when I, as a child and when I started seriously looking into a lot of this, it was just his life, you know, and I knew which direction it had gone. So it didn't really surprise me exactly. But when we started really getting into it, the fact that he could, you know, in those days, it was not really expected that you go to school beyond eighth grade. For him, as someone who was on his own and having to survive on his own, to make the decision to finish high school, first of all, that was really an amazing decision. And I did not realize until we started putting all the pieces together exactly how impressive the Olympic story was and how intense Dad's story was.
Judy, you talked about that adjective to describe your dad's childhood, discarded. Then he got to college. He was a loner, but he found this team, this group of eight other young men. What did that bond mean to him?
You know, he had spent so much of his time being self-sufficient and ferociously not trusting anybody. I mean, he'd learned about trusting, and trusting brings you pain. And he had sort of vowed that he was never going to trust anybody, not with his life, with his future again, until he got in with this group of guys. It was kind of like magic. He could trust them. And I asked him at one point, why did you keep coming back? Why go through all of that pain and exhaustion? And what he said, and I expected him to say, because the university would provide me a job. But that wasn't what he said. What he said was just, they needed me.
We cannot talk about all the amazing adventures, hardships, luck that your father experienced. You just have to read The Boys in the Boat to find out about that. But it centers around this amazing 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. The UW men's crew got there against staggering odds, mm-hmm. of all types. The team won this come-from-behind victory. That story in itself is kind of amazing. From the outside, oh my gosh. From the inside, from your father's own life, what did this all mean to him?
You know, it wasn't so much, I don't think, the Olympic win. The important thing was anywhere that they went, anything that they did, that they not let the team down. Their main goal was to not be the person that gave in, which made them pretty much unbeatable. And I don't think anybody like the German crew would have understood that.
Judy Willman, you know this now.
I do.
Did your father talk about this while you were growing up?
Not really. You know, I got other stuff to do. I'm a grown-up kid. I'm a housewife with two kids. I have no time. I never asked those questions. It wasn't until he and I had time at my house during his last 3.5 years.
Where is that gold medal now?
It's down at the university, at the Conybeare Shell House.
Well, there's not just the gold medal. The Husky Clipper, the boat that
yes.
the boys raced, hangs in the dining hall of Conybeare Shell House.
Right.
Your father's letter sweater
yes,
is there.
Yes, his Letterman sweater.
Do you go back there?
Oh, yeah, I'm back there all the time.
What's that like for you to walk in?
I cannot walk under the Husky Clipper without... I'm going to cry when I say this, but... To walk under there and to see It's upside down, so you can see the seats of all the guys, and you know who was in each of those seats. And you stop to think about where that shell has been and what those guys accomplished in that shell, and it just makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. I can't go in there without that happening.
People who never knew your father except through Dan Brown's words respond the same way that you did, maybe not quite as emotionally, but it's an emotional story. Why do you think it's so powerful?
Well, in the first place, it's just a heck of a story. I mean, it's a heck of an underdog, against the odds kind of a sports story. And it hits so many things like sacrificial companionship and longing for home and love and redemption and grief. And it is something that touches at what it is in us that makes us human.
Judy Willman is the daughter of Joe Rance, one of the boys in that legendary boat. The Boys of 36 is the PBS documentary based on that story of the University of Washington rowing team. It premieres tonight at 9 o'clock on Seattle's KCTS television. And in a few minutes on KUOW's The Record, more Seattle history in the form of ghost stories. That's coming up in 15 minutes. You're with KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. There is an island in South Puget Sound, McNeil Island, where the state of Washington houses violent sex offenders. It's the Special Commitment Center. And the people who are detained there are suing the facility because the water that's coming out of their faucets and showers is brown. I mean, coffee brown. Reporter Kenny Auker with the News Tribune in Tacoma told me how the water got that way.
Pipes at McNeil Island are from who knows when and run who knows where, because the island was used as a federal prison starting in the late 1800s until 1980, and then was used as a state prison until 2008. And so the infrastructure for the water system is from some point far back in the past.
The state says the water, yeah, it's brown, it's got sediment, but it's safe. So what's the argument?
The argument is that they can't shower and get clean, and that they don't want to shave when they're using the water. They're not certain that it's safe, but they don't necessarily have the means to take the water independently to a testing facility because they can't leave the island.
So when those sediments are flowing and the water is running brown, the commitment center passes out bottled water. So the residents don't have to drink the water, but they don't even want to shower and wash and shave in it.
Yeah, and they also don't want to drink it even when it's not running brown. Many of the employees who work at the Special Commitment Center go to McNeil Island every day with a jug of water in their hand, but the residents don't have that opportunity.
Why would the staff be drinking bottled water if the residents' water is safe?
That's where part of their grievance comes from.
Yeah, if it's not good enough for you, it's not good enough for us.
Essentially, yes.
Is brown water the worst condition that residents at McNeil Island face?
They sued over the color of the water, the temperature of the water, that it wasn't staying hot long enough for them to take showers, and then the quality and temperature of the air. There are also lawsuits about environmental tobacco smoke, where people who are not smoking were subjected to tobacco smoke. And the state has changed their practices since the lawsuit has been filed, but the lawsuit is still standing for the amount of time that people were exposed to it before.
Okay, so the residents of the McNeil Island Sex Offender Commitment Center say their water isn't
It's not clean. It doesn't smell good. They don't think it's safe. The state says it is safe, and basically that's the best you're going to get. What happens next?
The case is scheduled for trial in December, and at which point, when that's done, then there will be some sort of resolution if they don't settle before then.
If the state were to lose its case, what would the state have to do to make that water run clear?
I don't know. The state would obviously be required in some way to fix the problem and would probably be put on a federal time schedule to do so in the court settlement or the court ruling if they were to lose the case. But it's impossible to tell right now what that would be or what the cost would be.
I was just at the Alcatraz prison on vacation, the island prison off of San Francisco, a few weeks ago, and water was one of the reasons they shut that prison down. It's hard to provide some services on an island.
And that was why the state abandoned the McNeil Island Correction Facility when Christine Gregoire was governor, because it was so cost prohibitive to operate the prison there. But they've still face some of the same problems of ferrying workers out, ferrying all the supplies and equipment out. And now the prison infrastructure is not there for the Special Commitment Center to piggyback off of. So a lot of those same costs and issues are there, but without the Department of Corrections subsidizing it.
Reporter Kenny Ocker with the News Tribune based in Tacoma. He's covering this controversy over the brown water coming out of faucets and showers at the McNeil Island Special Commitment Center. We're tweeting out a link to his story right now at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. The presidential candidates have been criticizing free trade. Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump have called this proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal a disaster. Hillary Clinton has waffled on her support of the TPP. And what about President Obama?
Well, right now I'm president, and I'm for it. And I think I've got the better argument.
President Obama said today the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal will boost exports and create jobs.
It will reduce tariffs, taxes basically, on American goods from cars to crops, and make it easier for Americans to export into the fastest growing markets of the world.
And the president said America needs to adapt to globalization, not reject it.
It's not possible to cut ourselves off, given how integrated our economies are. And trying to pull up a drawbridge on trade would only hurt us and hurt our workers.
Is President Obama right on this? Is opposing a trade deal like pulling up a drawbridge? We're going to take a closer look at the arguments over free trade later this afternoon here on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Up at the top of the Space Needle, there's a restaurant. The food is kind of expensive. The view is incredible and ever-changing because that restaurant slowly spins. It's the world oldest, the world's oldest operating revolving restaurant. But the idea dates all the way back to the Roman Empire. The remains of Emperor Nero's revolving restaurant were discovered in 2009.
It was more of a dining room. And it was in Nero's sort of pleasure palace that he built on the Palatine Hill. It was called the Golden Palace or the Domus Aurea. And basically, it was a dining room that slowly spun, and then the ceiling above also spun. And it was just designed to entertain his guests.
Heather Wells Peterson wrote about the history of revolving restaurants for Lucky Peach magazine. She told me her interest in this revolving concept, well, it happened by accident.
I went to a wedding in New Orleans, and I had maybe one too many drinks, and it took me longer than it should have to realize that I was in a revolving bar. It's called the carousel bar, and it actually is decorated to look like a carousel, so you're spinning like you're on a carousel while you're there.
Wow, at a bar, that would seem to have mixed results.
Yeah, you don't really want extra spinning while you're there, but...
Right, which it seemed like it got you to ask a good question, which is, why would people want to spin while they eat and drink?
Yeah, it was something that I never really understood. It wasn't missing from my dining experience, but it seemed to, at least at one point, have been very popular in the United States to go to these restaurants.
What is behind that?
I think that the main driving force is actually pretty similar to Nero's, which is that during a time when a lot of technological advancements were being made here, specifically as we were ramping up for the Cold War, there was an emphasis on dazzling with these kinds of flashy things like a revolving restaurant where you are spinning and you don't really know how that's happening and it's a new experience. So it was more about impressing in that sense than I think about providing a really great dinner or a, you know, a peaceful date spot or something.
In fact, I get the impression you think the spinning can detract from the restaurant experience. You do use the word parasite.
When I first started thinking about revolving restaurants, I read a book by Chad Randall called Revolving Architecture, and he actually coined the term barnacle. And basically what he was saying is these revolving restaurants set up shop in places where there's already something to draw tourists. So, for instance, at Niagara Falls, the view is already built in, so you just build a revolving restaurant above it. Or in the case of Seattle, the Space Needle is already very tall, so if you put a restaurant on top of it, the view is already there. So that's what makes them sort of barnacles that attach to these hosts. And then once they're there, I think that maybe the operations of the restaurant is a little parasitic in the sense that you come for the view, but then you're stuck there for a dinner that might not be very delicious and might cost a lot of money.
Well, the revolvingness doesn't make the food bad. I mean, what's wrong? Bad food is bad, but what's wrong with adding an attraction on top of an attraction?
I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it. I have yet to hear of a revolving restaurant that has great food. So I don't know if it's just that places like that don't concentrate on that aspect of the experience or what, but I think for me at least, I don't really want to be slowly spinning, maybe slightly nauseous as I eat my food. So maybe that's part of it too.
Well, I have to admit, I haven't been to Seattle's favorite spinning restaurant since I was pretty young, but I did think it was awesome. Let's talk about the Space Needle. How did that come about?
The Space Needle was built for the World's Fair to showcase new technologies, and then later the restaurant was added to the top with that sort of idea that the view was already built in, so you might as well have the restaurant up there and take advantage of it.
Why is Seattle's Space Needle restaurant still spinning when so many have failed?
I don't know the exact answer to that question, but I can tell you that as I was doing my research about these restaurants and looking at writing about them, there's a real loyalty and love for the Space Needle restaurant that I did not see for most other revolving restaurants. And I think that maybe it's because the Space Needle itself, it makes sense a little bit more to have that sort of technological flash on top of something that's already very technologically flashy. And also, it's been there for a long time. And I think that, you know, tourists all over the country and even maybe the world know about it.
Well, as we say, a lot of the revolving restaurants in the U.S. and even Europe are falling out of favor, but they seem to be doing well in other countries. What's going on with that?
It seems to be that in countries that are currently developing, these restaurants are starting to catch on more. So places like India and China, there are a lot of these restaurants. And I think it has to do with that sort of drive to innovate and develop and take technology to its extent, and though this technology has existed for a long time, it's still a spectacle, as anyone who has into, say, the Space Needle would be able to say, however much the dining experience itself might not be enhanced by it. It's definitely spectacular.
So, Heather, do you think the age of the revolving restaurant in the United States is over, or will it come back around?
That's an interesting question, because I think there do seem to be cycles to some extent where we sort of return to these retro ideas. And one of the things I explored in my article was this sort of specific time that was right for the revolving restaurant and how it would have been so impressive then, and now it seems like a more of a relic. So I could see potentially in the future a, you know, hipster callback to the revolving restaurant, but I guess only time will tell.
Writer Heather Wells Peterson wrote a piece for the magazine Lucky Peach about the history of revolving restaurants, including Sky City in your Space Needle, which she says is the oldest operating revolving restaurant in the world. We're tweeting out a link to her story now at KUOW. Let's talk about changing Seattle now. From the gold rush to the tech explosion that we're having today, Seattle's always been changing. It's always been a boom town. And that kind of growth, it brings change, which means it also brings loss. Jamie Garbacik is trying to collect and preserve the stories of some of Seattle's disappearing places before the memories fade away. She's calling the project The Ghosts of Seattle Past.
I had breakfast with 30 elderly black men that went to Garfield High School who wanted to tell me all about what it was like at the first prom where there were interracial couples, at the first, you know, how the forced busing had completely changed the integration of their schools, of their friendships, and how that changed the black and white divide. And they were talking about a central district that I had been living in and that I had not seen, you know. And the more I talked to them, the more I understood that this just keeps happening over and over again. But by giving people a forum, this anthology, it raises people's voices that might not otherwise have the opportunity to speak to what's disappeared that was important to them, some places that were really crucial to them personally.
So you have this project, a kind of tribute, a commemoration of what's disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the feeling around that? Is it grief? Is it anger? Is it nostalgia?
I definitely think that it's all of those things, but my hope is that it's celebratory.
Celebratory.
Yeah. In fact, we threw an Irish wake for Lost Seattle Places on St. Patrick's Day. And, you know, an Irish wake is like a ruckus party, right? Instead of the dry, like drab mourning that you see at more traditional Western funeral.
So grief and celebration?
Yeah. Nostalgia is definitely a big part of it. You know, you mentioned that word before, and I think that's a key word. I think nostalgia is really productive.
Why is that?
You know, you have this sense that some place has to be really unique for it to have mattered that it disappeared, but it's not that. It's just wherever you spent a specific period of your life, like something that was really pivotal for you, and you've latched onto it, and when it disappears, it takes part of you with it. And I guess nostalgia gets this really bad rap in a city that's so dedicated to progress. But the thing about nostalgia is that it helps us remember, like, who we were, what a place is about, why we identified with here. And I think it contextualizes what matters about our city to us.
So you're not trying to stop change. This Ghosts of Seattle project
No.
is not about stopping development.
Not about
stopping. Why not? Why isn't this a keep things the way they are movement?
I think it's inevitable. I think change is inevitable. It wasn't a political protest. And that's not to say that, you know, I don't take issue with certain kinds of development, but I think I'd rather inform developers what mattered to Seattleites and have them take that into account going forward. I'm not trying to stop the halt of a growing city, but I don't want Seattle to suddenly be comprised of one demographic, or for people to not at least realize what was there before.
Is there a danger in focusing on what's lost and missing what's new and what's just changed?
I don't think there's any dearth of focus on what's new.
Hmm. We have plenty of that.
Yeah, I don't think that there's people are having a hard time finding the new great things that are popping up. And in no way am I trying to say that everything that's new is less legitimate or less exciting or less captivating. Just that there are many, many populations in Seattle whose places that they gathered, they have stories that should be shared. And I am trying to give them a forum for that.
What have you learned doing this Ghosts of Seattle Past project?
Well, one of the things that kept coming up for me, I think it's very easy to think that your Seattle is a very specific place, or that Seattle is a very specific place, that it has a particular like flavor to it, a smell to it, you know, a certain vibe and energy. And in fact, that's just your little pocket of the universe. And it's really important that we reach outside of that and kind of say like, oh, well, what was important about this space before it was this? You know, like I missed this record store that disappeared, but before it was a record store, it was a hardware store. Before it was a hardware store, it was a speakeasy jazz club. And all of those places had like tremendous value. And there might be somebody living next door to you that has a lot of feelings about that other version of it. And the more that we start really talking to each other about that, I think we're going to find that we'll become a much more inclusive city, and we can share space and we can share the value of what the space means to us.
Jamie Garbacik is the curator of the Ghosts of Seattle Past project. We're tweeting out a link to her project right now at KUOW. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and the big news of today that we can't believe we haven't gotten to yet, this is one of the most universal recommendations in all of public health. Floss your teeth every day to prevent gum disease and cavities. The federal government in the past has told you to floss. The American Dental Association has told you to floss. Dentists and hygienists give their patients floss for free. The problem, it turns out, is that we don't know it works. The federal government has removed its flossing advice from its website because there is not enough scientific evidence that flossing is effective. Seattle dentist Dr. George Knutson, welcome to you.
Thank you.
The people who don't floss are ecstatic right now. Doctor, we're off the hook, right?
Well, Maybe you are, but I certainly my patients won't be. I think it's rubbish. I think, you know, the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Well, we see a lot of people who don't do it who could have used that prevention. Ask people who deal with the public every day, and you'll find out a different story.
Well, yeah, you deal with it every day, and I've seen the before and after signs, the people pushing me to do it, except the scientific evidence is really scant. The studies supporting flossing were poorly done. Some of them were funded by floss manufacturers. What gives?
Well, there are people that don't need it. There are not very many of them, but there are. And but ask specialists, especially the dental hygienist. My God, what have you done to them? They have to deal with this, you know, every 6 months, and with people with disease every 3 months. It's people that have serious joint replacements or heart valve replacements. Many people, they can lose these their heart valve. They can lose their joint replacement if they get bacteria in their bloodstream, and that's what plaque has on it. And
well, why do you think the results in favor of flossing haven't been more resounding and clear?
Well, it's hard to measure, that's for sure, because everybody's different. You know, some people don't form tartar. Most people do. Some people's plaque has the right wrong kind of bacteria in it. It's hard to say, but we see it all the time. And decay in between your teeth, that's where it usually starts. So what are you going to do there? Just leave that stuff sitting there? I don't know. It's crazy.
So you're still recommending that people floss. Is it because you're sure that flossing will overall prevent gum disease and cavities, or are you just saying, it can't hurt?
No, I'd say it's an ounce of prevention that will save you a lot of grief in the future.
And I've heard some advice. Do you confirm this, that we shouldn't saw back and forth? We're doing it wrong?
Well, if you're doing that, you are, but we always teach them to go up and down on the tooth. But, you know, it's, you know, if you're not doing it right, it's not going to work. But we heartily recommend it because we've seen the problems that it can occur if they don't keep them clean.
Seattle dentist George Knutson saying, keep at the flossing. Thanks, Doc.
Okay, you betcha. Thanks. Goodbye.
Appreciate it. Again, the federal government dropping its recommendation, saying the scientific evidence is lacking. Speaking of unscientific, we surveyed you on Twitter for your reaction to today's news. 25% of you summed up your reaction with the word skeptical. You are skeptical, as Dr. Knutson is. Perhaps you're a dedicated flosser. You may be flossing right now. 35% said you're relieved at the news. Maybe you don't floss every day. The biggest number of you, 40%, said the word that best describes your reaction is dancing. You non-flossers, you just got a talking to by Seattle dentist George Knutson. You can check out that survey and weigh in yourself at KUOW. And thanks for listening today to KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, streaming live at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke.